Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and this is the 10 Adventures podcast. Each week, we talk to real people about real adventures as they explore this incredible planet we all live on.
Today on the 10 Adventures podcast, Karen is back with me co-hosting. Hi, Karen. Welcome back to the studio.
Yay!
Today's a really interesting podcast. We're talking with Ruth Millington, and Ruth recently won the Paige Turner Award for nonfiction with her book about surviving a devastating earthquake while on holiday in Iran. The book will be published soon, but I'm just so fascinated with this story. I've asked Ruth to come on the podcast, and she's agreed. So hi, Ruth. Welcome to the 10 Adventures podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So we're going to get to a bit about, you know, this incredible story of yours, but maybe can you just frame a little bit about yourself before we get onto that aspect? Where you live, what your kind of background is?
Right. Well, currently I live in Sheffield in England, which is in the north of England. Originally, before I started really traveling, when I was a teenager, I had post-viral fatigue syndrome. Made me very, very sick. I had to resit my exams before I went off to university again. And as a result, I always sort of felt a bit behind things. I went and studied law. I think I'd watched too much LA law, and I kind of wanted to set myself up financially because I had this big desire to go and travel. But I thought if I do certain jobs, I won't be able to do that. So I kind of did a law degree and then sort of got into, you know, practicing as a lawyer. And although it was very interesting, I wasn't really a girl Friday, as I always say. I wasn't great in an office. So between, you know, changing jobs or going on holiday, I go off somewhere wacky, you know, I might go to Bangladesh and everyone will just raise their eyebrows when I say I'm off to Bangladesh, or I go, you know, some China, which back in the 90s was, you know, very, very different to what it is now. Over the years, I think as a traveler, you never get rid of that bug. So you have to make adaptations to your life to fulfill your dreams.
So the way it started off was you were working and then you just do travels to exotic locales.
That's true. And it was around the millennium where I suddenly had, I can't do this anymore. I can't go and sit on a trading floor in London. I think I was just going nutty. And I'd just been to Nepal for a 3-week trip. And I came back and I was hedonistic. And I thought, I've got to take some time out now. I need to go traveling for, do a round the world trip. So I said to my boss, can I take a sabbatical for a year? And he said, no, because you won't want to come back, which was at the time very upsetting, but with hindsight, he was being very wise. And I went off for a year, then ended up in Australia, working for one of the investment banks there for about a year, and then did another year's full round the world trip. It was then, after that, I came back to London, got a job again in the city. It wasn't easy, but I thought, you know, got to pay the rent, etc. And then went off to Iran, and that's when the real big changes happened.
I think it's really interesting. You know, your kind of experience is something I've heard so many times of, you know, trying to work a regular job, but having this passion to explore different cultures and countries. You were kind of, you know, battling against this. I've got to have a job. I need to explore. It's something I felt, you know, I was an executive in a consulting firm before and, you know, just realized this is not the future for me. How were you grappling with that going back, you know, into the early part of the millennium, going to work? You know, did you realize every day that it was the wrong fit for you? Or was it just something that every once in a while I thought, oh, this doesn't feel right for me?
There's a saying in Taoism about if you put a tree in concrete, for example, it's not going to flourish. Or is some similar expression to that. And I felt my feet were actually in concrete. And I think when you do put your feet in concrete, you're not going to flourish. So, it made me realize that what I needed to do, that I then thought, well, how can I address this? But I did battle with, you know, I've studied, I've worked really hard to be a lawyer. I was, you know, 30 at the time. I was thinking, you know, do you want to have a family? So as a woman as well, you've got these, you know, you do have a ticking time bomb, for want of a word, you know, better word, as a woman you do. And you do have to make sort of, what do I want to go? But this overriding thing to be a nomad was always in me. So I just said, I've got to go. And I was really nervous about it. But as soon as I got to the airport, my parents took me And I said to them, I'll be back in a year. And as I left, I went through the exit gates. I knew I wouldn't be back for 3 years.
I like the comment that you made earlier about asking for a year sabbatical and it being denied, and that perhaps your boss had some sage insight, because it makes me think about you, Richard, and then a bit about me. I think we both had a similar experience that we took some time off to travel and then things really got changed around. So, boy, we're hearing a strong theme here, hey?
I think it's interesting. You know, we're all a doctor, a lawyer, a business person. From the outside, we all had successful careers, but, you know, internally, they weren't fulfilling. And I think there's a big difference between what other people look and they say, oh, they must be fulfilled. But internally, fulfillment isn't always just a nice title and a nice salary. There's a lot of things which, you know, aren't monetary at all, which, at least for me, really drive, you know, a lot of my satisfaction with life is like being outdoors, exploring the world, much more than, you know, a nice paycheck. You know, money's kind of not even motivating for me at all. It's doing things that I'm passionate about. I know you're the same, Karen, but is that similar with you as well, Ruth?
Yeah, I think there's two issues there. I think it's really important to be grounded. Sometimes when you're on the road, you do meet people who have just been traveling for a lifetime, and they seem very, they don't seem grounded enough. So I think it's really important to be grounded, and that you can achieve through different ways. It might be you have a base back in a country, you might have a flat or something, just so that you know you have that security you can go back to. And I think that's really important. But also, when you're so unhappy in a job, and it might not be the actual, you might have lovely work colleagues. I'm not saying it's not that. It's just that it's just not right for you. You start spending money to fulfill that gap. So you start throwing away money. You're going out for dinner on expensive dinners. You know, London's expensive. I remember Dad saying to me, stop spending so much money on going out for dinner. You know, you want to go off traveling around the world. And then when I do travel, I always travel on a budget. I do it for a reason, because I don't necessarily want to go into a fantastic hotel and not see the real world for what it is. I mean, obviously, I stay in a clean, you know, place, and, you know, and hopefully I don't get electrocuted by the shower. Some places you do go into. But, you know, that is so much more fulfilling, I personally find.
So, I mean, it sounds this theme of kind of starting to spread your wings and leave behind a lot of the stability of your career. But you mentioned that it really changed after the experience you had in Iran.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'll talk a bit about Iran, but when I came back out of Iran, I felt so displaced. I'd been in this really horrific situation. Came back to England and I had had the press jump on me. I had hundreds of phone calls a day from the press. I then went back into work about a week later and I went onto a trading floor. And everyone had obviously seen me in the press and everyone's walking around like I'm a bomb about to explode, because they just didn't know emotionally how I was. And it was a very, very interesting time that. But I remember sitting down and looking at a contract. And I did capital markets work, and I would be sitting looking at loan agreements, $100 million loan agreements. And it just meant nothing to me. I was just like looking at a blank page. And I think from that feeling of displacement, feeling I wanted to go back out, that I knew once I'd had time to recover from the trauma, I had to make some really big decisions in my life. And it was a couple of years later, actually, that big decision was actually made for me. I got made redundant in very weird circumstances. I remember some of the traders coming up to me and one of them saying, it's like there's been, you know, some godly intervention here. This is just weird how you've been made redundant. And everyone's like, why Ruth? Why Ruth? And I think it was almost, you know, my life saying, you've got to make that change now. You've got to really, really fulfill your dreams and not get away from that trading floor environment.
You know, I've actually heard that from other people, and I kind of feel similar myself at sometimes, that this path I'm on, it's seizing these opportunities that, you know, in some cases people might say it's terrible you were made redundant, but your approach was, it allowed you to pursue this dream and this life that's really authentic for you. I didn't know anything about the BAM earthquake here in Canada. It wasn't, you know, wasn't covered very much. I've subsequently read about it. It's, you know, a devastating earthquake. Can you maybe share a little bit about what happened? You know, what was this? You know, why were you in Iran? What was the earthquake? What happened? Because I think that's, you know, a really interesting part of this story.
Well, funny enough, is I'd done a huge amount of travel elsewhere around the world, but not a huge amount in the Middle East. And a couple of years before I'd gone to Iran, I was in Mongolia and I met a future friend on Ulaanbaatar railway station. We always kept in touch and he was a maniac traveler. I thought I was bad. He was a different level even than me. And we always kept in touch and we'd, you know, I was still at one point still doing around the world trip and he flew out from Germany. We met up and so forth. And I was working back in the city and it was coming up to Christmas and he called me up and said, you know, do you want to go to Jordan? And I said, yeah, great. Put the phone down. And I thought, no, I don't want to go to Jordan. I want to go to Iran. And I had this very strong sense of purpose that I had to go to Iran. Couldn't put my finger on it. Picked the phone back up and said to him, can we go to Iran, please? And he said, well, funny enough, I was going to ask you if you wanted to, but I was slightly worried. There's been a few kidnappings and so forth. And at the time, you know, Iran at that stage, it was on the axis of evil. You know, America government was, you know, you must not go there, et cetera, et cetera. But I felt this really strong calling to go. And we ended up going. So I left on Christmas Eve, got there. I met my friend later on in BAM. But the first, I flew overnight and arrived in Kerman, first of all, from Tehran. Hung her out there. And then I went down to BAM that evening to meet my friend. And we went out for dinner. We came back and the idea was to go to the Agha Bam, which is a big citadel, very old citadel, which had just been completely rebuilt and it had just reopened. So we decided to start in southern Iran where Bam is and sort of work our way back up north to Tehran before we flew out. And so the idea was to get up early and go and see the sunrise. But before sunrise came, the earthquake hit, the 6.5 magnitude earthquake, and it happened at 5:26 a.m. I remember that very well, in the morning, and it was pitch black, and it just came out of the blue, this earthquake.
So that must have been terrifying.
Well, I wasn't aware of any earthquakes happening in that part of Iran. I mean, it is a massive earthquake zone. And, you know, even in Tehran, they have huge fault lines everywhere. I think one of the hospitals was built on a fault line. And in BAM, they, around that whole area, there was no major fault line, not that they knew of. And the only thing that had happened the night before, and it was about 10 o'clock, and I get really bad jet lag. I just can't talk when I've got off a plane, basically, for about 5 hours. So you should have to go to bed. And I, you know, got down there. I was just exhausted. And I went into our, we were sharing a room, and I went to lay down and said, I'm going to bed so we can get up early. And there was this massive crash and the whole room shook and it felt as though like a big lorry had just crashed into this room. And my friend stuck his head around the door and said, they've just been having some weird tremors. And I was like, oh, whatever. I went to bed. And the next minute, the noise, my God. And my friend was dragging me off the bed in the pitch blackness.
So by that, you mean that was how you experienced the big earthquake then? You had a vague appreciation of the tremors beforehand? Because I read about that as well. Like, Richard, I didn't know anything about that earthquake. And I read that there were some initial, you know, shakes before the big earthquake came.
Yeah, so they'd been, I think they had been happening, some very minor ones had been happening for a couple of days. There was that one about 10 o'clock at night, which I experienced. And it also turns out there was a massive one at 4 a.m. in the morning, quite a bit longer one. And some families had in the city had gone out to sleep in the courtyards because they were concerned a big earthquake would happen. But I just slept through that. I was just exhausted. And my friend subsequently told me he started dreaming about being on a boat on the waves on the ocean and woke up and this earthquake was hit. So he, in the pitch black, imagine no light, imagine him being in a strange room. And I woke to the sensation of being dragged up, down the bed. And it was, BAM is in a desert area. So at night, particularly in winter, it's cold. It's quite warm during the day, but it's cold at night. And I was in my sleeping bag. And I remember being the sensation of being dragged down the bed, kind of coming to, and then being pulled off the bed, and my friend shouting, "It's an earthquake, it's an earthquake." And I was suddenly woke up, and the room was jumping up by about a foot. It was immense. It was like being on a trampoline. And the next minute, all I know is I went flying across the room, and I got flown about 10, 15 foot across the room, landed on my friend's bed, and then the roof came in on me. And I was smashed on the head by bricks, you name it, falling debris. And I lay there thinking, if I don't get out now, I'm going to die. Because the building was coming in. And the noise was horrific. One of the issues I had about writing the book is I couldn't quite describe the noise. Like, the earth was groaning. It sounded like some monster was underneath the earth. And these are obviously the tectonic plates moving, but they groan. And I could actually physically hear each, as the walls were jumping up and down, I could actually hear the slamming down of the walls as it went up and down. And then to the point where everything started disintegrating, I could actually hear individual big bricks smashing against each other. I heard glass smashing. It was just the most horrific sound. And so when the ceiling came in on me, the roof, I was thinking, I'm going to die. And I put my hand out, and miraculously my friend's hand was there. So he dragged me up. But then I had the difficulty, and again, this is pitch black, I'm just in my pajamas, no shoes on, and I'm, oh my God, I'm trapped in this thing. I can't get out of this thing, and I'm screaming to get out of it. You can imagine, you know, you've got your sleeping bag locked up to your neck because it's cold. You can't, in that, and I had a male sleeping bag, so it was the other side. So I was forgetting which side it was on. I was like, oh my God, oh my God. My friend was screaming, stand in the door, and I'm screaming, don't. No, so he was screaming, we've got to get out. And I was screaming, stand in the door, it's our only hope. And I somehow managed to get myself out. He pulled me towards me, and then he was slamming this door. I mean, I couldn't see any of this, but when you're in that situation, you've got such heightened senses because you're in survival mode. You kind of sense things. I could sense him in front of me. I could sense this whole building literally disintegrating behind me. And he kicked the door. I heard him push the door, even though the sound around was just incredible. And then he grabbed me by the head and he pushed me through the door. And I remember my face scraping against all this stuff. Again, I don't know what it was, but it was probably brick. And he pushed me out and I just ran. I ran for a couple of meters in bare feet, just a pair of pajamas on, and I hit a wall of rubble. I didn't realize at the time it was a wall of rubble. It was a wall. And I just scrambled up, and I knew my friend would be running behind me, you know, like a raging bull. And he's a big guy. So I thought he's going to crash into, and I just scrambled up. And I stood on the top of this mound of rubble, and my friend joined me. And then it went deathly quiet. Deathly quiet. There was no noise, except there was this whirling dust everywhere. And the whirling dust, it allowed, although I don't think there was moonlight, but there was so much dust in the air, it almost created a slight glow. And I looked around, and I remember saying to my friend, "Where's the hotel gone?" It was completely down. Everything was down.
And so what's going through your mind there? You know, you're a huge earthquake. The hotel you're in is gone. You know, you've been hit by bricks. Like, what are your first thoughts at that point in time?
Shock, obviously, that you've managed to get out. But then the reality struck was there's people in this little guest house with us. We were staying in a guest house called Akbar's Guest House. And my immediate reaction is, there's other big people buried. Where are they? Where are they? And my friend said to me, well, before this happened, after a few seconds, started hearing distant wailing. And it came from all around the city. So if you imagine standing outside at night and seeing the horizon, no lights, just the horizon, and hearing a very low, dull moaning and wailing, that's all I heard. So it was really horrific. So you realize this whole city's down. You couldn't see any buildings. Everything was just obliterated. And the next minute, I heard this man shouting, "Natalie, Natalie." And I looked ahead of me, and 40 yards in front of me, I saw this mound, and we ran over to him. Now, remember, this is a building which is collapsed. Buildings don't collapse nicely. They have girders. They have gas cylinders. There's electrical wiring. It's horrific what you're on. It's like a bomb site, essentially. So we are running over that with bare feet. And I didn't know if I was going to step on an electrical wire, which was still alive. You just didn't know. But in those circumstances, you don't even think about it. It's like, I've got to get to this person. So we ran across. And I came to what this man was shouting at. And I looked down on the ground, and there was matted hair and blood. All I could just see was the top of her head. And got on her hands and knees and realised it was a woman buried alive. And she'd been buried standing up. It turns out she'd been, him and Natalie and her boyfriend had been running out the door, but she'd been basically, the building had come in on her. And all I could hear was this suffocating noise and seeing this blood-stained head. And I remember taking this deep breath, thinking, oh, my God, what do I do? And then it was like, get her out. And from then on, kind of went into this emergency mode. It was like I was doing a business deal. When I used to work in investment banking as a lawyer, just used to work horrendous hours and became almost slightly robotic to get the work done. And I kind of went into that mode. So it had a skill. It was a skill I'd learned from being a lawyer, ironically, but it helped me in that situation. It was like, right, put emotion out as you do as a lawyer. Don't think of the, you know, you just get on with it. You get on with it because you've got a deal to do. And I remember we started digging around her face to get the rubble off. And she, you know, and we were scrambling and she had bloodstained face and so forth. And she was semi-conscious. And I remember clearing her airways with my hand. And I didn't have any first aid training. I'd only, well, I wasn't a medic, should I say. I'd had first aid training about 6 years earlier. And I remembered some core issues about that. If I needed to resuscitate someone, you know, make sure their airways are clear. But other than that, I didn't have any skills, medical skills like that. But I knew we had to make sure she could breathe. So we sort of cleared it to here. And then I turned around to her boyfriend and said, there's other people buried. Can you get her out? Because we've got to rescue the rest of the people. And from then on, for the next 2 hours, we had a very large area. It's a hotel. It's down. It's a big area. And we went to two separate sides, my friend and I. And we got onto our knees and we shouted down into the rubble. And this went on for 2 hours in the pitch blackness. And so I would stand up, walk a few feet, kneel down, shout into the rubble, put my ear down and do this. And I went in a line up and down for 2 hours. After that, when light came, it was when I heard the first scream from down below. And it was a man's voice. And my friend also heard someone in the corner. And it, as soon as I heard it, I started scrambling for them. And it took me about 5 to 6 hours to get those particular people out. Didn't realise there were two people. And they'd been in one of the rooms. And they were in separate bedrooms. It was the dormitory room they were in. And they were thrown several, probably about 20 feet. The bed came with them. And it concertinaed itself around them, a metal bed frame. And when you've got people buried, you don't know, you know, are their legs up the back? They've got broken backs. You just don't know the extent of the injuries. And once I'd located those two, and I managed to clear their heads, and their heads were back to back, which is ironic. So they'd been thrown this huge, quite a big distance. The bed's wrapped around them and their heads are back to back. So how they'd fallen. And then it was like, and I said to them, I'm going to come back for you, but I've got to find the other people. And so I started this other search for other people and saw, because now it was dawn and light. I saw a bedstead, the top of the frame, and my immediate instinct was there's somewhere underneath that. And they were, it was a guy who later discovered was called Hanno, And he was in, his bed was where the only remaining wall was standing. And it took me about 8 hours to dig him out. But the problem was, is I was working against this huge wall, which could have collapsed on top of me. So it was very, very dangerous. There were massive, massive tremors happening all the time. Every couple of minutes, you know, you'd have, they were probably almost as strong as the earthquake itself initially after it. It was just massive. And between us, my friend, he found a couple of people. We worked between each other to try and find who there were. And there were 12 people buried all together. So it was a big operation moving between people and trying to calm people down, saying, I'm coming back, you know, but I've got to go and find this other person. I know we didn't know the setup of the hotel. I didn't. I'd arrived there at 9 o'clock the night before, so I hadn't even seen the hotel in the light. So I just had to look at the footprint of the, you know, the potential building, what it was, and sort of try and work out, you know, is this a bedroom here? Is this a part of one of the bungalows here? It was very difficult.
It sounds like just overwhelming, that experience. And I must say, you've really painted a picture with words. Like, I can really see a lot of this as you're describing it. So I imagine your book's going to be quite a read, because just these words, I can really see it in my eye, especially when you talk about the dust in the air. I was thinking about, you know, you were saying these walls were threatening to collapse as you were trying to dig people out, and thinking about the bravery that would be involved in doing that. And what I started wondering as you were talking is, I wonder if I could do that. And then that got me wondering, did you see yourself as a brave person before you went on this trip? Like, were you someone who said, yeah, I'm pretty brave? Or did this all come from the unknown?
Absolutely not. I'll give you an example. The night before, I slept overnight in Tehran Airport because I arrived about 1 a.m. in the morning, and then I had an internal flight, I think about 7, and it just wasn't worth the hassle of getting to Tehran and back. And when I was in the airport, there was a young baby sitting next to me with its grandmother who suddenly started choking. And I'm like, ooh, you know, what do I do? And this child starts almost going blue in the face, literally. It was getting really quite bad. And I felt so helpless. I kind of knew what to do, but I was too frightened. And before I could do anything, his grandmother grabbed him, held him upside down, slapped him on the back and spat some food out, whatever was causing the blockage. And the child lived to see the day, thank goodness. But I remember sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I'd be awful if I had to save someone now. It was just ironic that it happened. 24 hours later, I'm having to do that. But I think what it does show is that never underestimate the power of the human spirit, of your abilities to do stuff. Never judge yourself. Never say you can't do something because you just don't know.
And you talked about when the earthquake was actually happening, you had this heightened awareness that you could just sense so much going on. Do you feel like you had that heightened awareness as you were digging people out? Or did it change to, you know, nose down, get the job done? Because sometimes when I'm in that mind space where you're, you know, you talked about being robotic, I almost feel like I'm filtering outside input out, you know, just to keep focused on the task.
I think there was a combination of both. When I knew that there was someone below me, I became, in a sense, numb just to focus on that job. But when I was locating people, I used more of my intuition. I think one thing of traveling, which I've found over the years, you become quite intuitive about stuff. You kind of sense when things might happen or something, you know, something odd happens, and you kind of think, well, actually, there's a reason for this. And in that moment of being in the earthquake, I just remember thinking, looking at pieces of ground, thinking, there's someone there. Don't know how, I just knew they were. There was no sign. There's not like a foot sticking out or something, but just had this something, you know, there's something, someone's there.
So what you're describing actually seems, you know, to me, I've heard people describe being in avalanches. And, you know, multiple burials, and there's some very similar situations where, you know, there's one person survives that is trying to locate people. And they talk about, you kind of just don't even know what you're doing. You're like a robot. And then all of a sudden it hits them what's going on. Help arrives, a chopper comes in. When was that moment for you where you kind of all of a sudden just said, holy crow, like, you know, you kind of take stock and realize what happened. You kind of turn off this robot to try and save people. Was that during the day, or did this go on for longer that, you know, you kind of were just not yourself? You're just in this kind of fight or flight response.
I think, well, if I paint the picture, every hospital was down. All the police were killed. Fire, rescue, everyone was down. There was no help. The first sign of help I saw from, well, what I suspect is help, is a helicopter flying above at midday. And I think it was an army helicopter. I can't be sure. But there was no one. So I still was on this, remember looking up thinking, when's help going to come? But not think, you know, realizing it probably isn't. So I just kept digging. No help came at all during the day. We used sheets that people were sleeping in as stretchers to get them down to the roadside. And there were some really horrific injuries. And when you're trying to carry people in, you know, using blankets or sheets or whatever, there are dead weights and you're on bare feet and so forth, and got them down to the side of the road. I'd managed at one point to go down to the road and try and get some local people to come and help me. But that was just so difficult because, you know, I looked like a ghost. I was covered in this white dust, which I didn't realize at the time until sort of later on. So I'm this ghostly figure running along the road, trying, screaming for help. And I realized if I screamed, people would run away. So I went up to people. I couldn't speak Farsi, but I sort of put my hands together and said, please, please, you know, come help. And brought two young women onto the ground and a young man, but they were just so traumatized, they ended up walking off after half an hour, and they weren't helping the situation. They were walking on ground where I knew people were buried. After we got people down to the road, we were looking at trying to get them out of Bam up to a place called Kamam, because that would be, it's about a 3-hour drive away. And we were just hoping the earthquake hadn't been that extensive that it would have destroyed Kamam as well. So we looked at hot wiring a car, you know, it was just horrific. There was just so many cars on the road because people had driven in from the surrounding area to find their loved ones. And people were just zombies in these cars. And I couldn't quite figure out. And then I'd look at the car would go past me and the boot would be open and there'd be dead bodies rolled up in blankets. And there'd be, you know, 5 bodies in the back of a vehicle or inside a vehicle. They'd be just piled up. I remember seeing one vehicle thinking, who's that sat in the passenger seat? And I realized it was someone dead and they just had to put so many bodies in the vehicles. So again, I kept in that survival mode and we managed to get someone to get us driven up to Kamam. But then we had to get them into this hospital and it was just a war zone. There were thousands been brought up in. But going back to that question, I think it wasn't until that evening and some local guides who approached us and said, how can we help? And when we knew the people were in the hospital, safe for that time being, they took us back to their home and I rested in one of the rooms. And I remember looking in the mirror and thinking, what the hell has gone on? And that's when it started. Whoa, you know, the magnitude of the situation.
One thing that kind of blew me away when I was reading about this, the city of Bam only had 40 or 45,000 people. The devastation of the earthquake, there's over 25,000 deaths, 30,000 injuries, you know, from the surrounding areas. And it really was like, you know, the buildings were all mud and brick. It was calamitous. You know, it's something you think you've described it. It actually reads worse than what you describe, which is incredible because it just seems a horrifying account. But this is, you know, an incredibly massive disaster that, you know, you were right there for, which is just remarkable to hear what happened. So what happened after that period? You know, did you just want to get away or did you want to stay and continue to help? Could you help? What happened that night and the following days?
So what happened is when we'd got people into the hospital, I managed to get into contact because one of the surgeons gave me his mobile phone. And remember, this is 2003, so we don't have sophisticated smartphones like we do these days. And I was calling all these embassies. It was the 26th of December in the UK. That's Boxing Day. And you know, everyone's still on holiday. Everyone in the embassy, there was no one there, managed to get through. And I think it was the French embassy, leave a message. And obviously they called around the rest of the embassies because I'd taken every one of the survivors, their details.
Oh, wow. That's incredible that you thought of that.
Yeah, I thought, I remember taking them down the road and just making a, you know, a list of who they were, what the names were, where they were from. And then when these two guides came to help as interpreters, and they took us out of the hospital. And let me just paint a picture of this hospital. There were thousands of people outside bringing in the injured. Thousands. They had guards with guns on because people were so frantic. It was one of those scenes where you could see in the darkness people's hands in the air screaming for help. It was that horrific. And when you actually went in the hospital, there's just bodies everywhere of the injured, everywhere. And these surgeons, amazing, and the doctors and nurses, on the outwards, appearing so calm. But that night, we had a call about 1 o'clock in the morning saying we needed to get the people we'd rescued to Cremorne Hospital because they had to evacuate them. But of course, there's not going to be the ambulances for it, not that sort of disaster. So our two guides, well, the two guides who had kindly helped us, Jamal and Hussein, they said, look, we'll drive you to the hospital again. And we were talking about how to get people to the hospital. And we know we're talking about, we're going to put them in the boot of the car. I'll sit in the boot of the car, whatever, to get them there. And we did, over a period of time, manage to get them to the airport. And it was a scene out of, you know, this horrific scene of people just lying on the floor, you know, and we all had ID numbers put on our heads. And one was like, you're going to survive two. Two was, could be a risk of you dying. Three, you might not make it. But they had to do that so that the staff and the rescue teams could monitor people. And I remember seeing, and this is Iran. Iran's been under a very difficult government over the years. And so people have always relied on their families. But in a situation like that, all the families were killed. I saw young women just lying there on their own, babies killed, all families wiped out. I subsequently met one woman a year later when I went back down there. And everyone she'd ever known her entire life had been killed, 700 people. So you can see how cataclysmic this was. And then we did get flown up to Tehran. Iran Airways put on these special emergency flights. But, you know, getting injured people into a plane and off takes a long time. So we were sat on the runway for about 4 hours before we took off and then getting people out. But we eventually did get up to Tehran. I remember flying in and just seeing this line of ambulances queuing up. And then we got taken up to Iran and I got put into hospital for about 3 days. And I remember walking towards the hospital because by this stage we were put into two separate ambulances. And as we drove up, I remember saying to the staff, the medical staff, this is injured here. And then I kind of walked out the back of them as they're being pushed in. And as I walked towards the hospital doors, my body just gave way and I fell to the ground. And before I landed on the floor, two porterlies came up and carried me in, and one said in broken English, you're safe now.
It sounds like just a horrific experience. Obviously, at the time, it was completely overwhelming. Often those kind of experiences, though, can affect people, you know, going forward, months, years down the line. Do you feel like it affected you?
In the aftermath, when I got back to England, I had mentioned, you know, how I felt displaced. I felt I wanted to go back and help. That was my core thing. I wanted to go back and help. And I remember people I got to know at the British Embassy very kindly said to me at the time, I think you need to rest, Ruth, a bit. We're taking care of that element. We're working with the Iranian authorities to help. But that following year was just a blur. It was an absolute, I can't remember anything. Nothing made any sense. And you feel this incredible sense of displacement. And you kind of get on with things. And, you know, trauma manifests itself in different ways. But I've always been sort of very positive. I've always kind of thought, you know, this happened to me for a reason. And, you know, some people said to me, you know, do you have survivor guilt? Well, no, because if I hadn't survived, I wouldn't have been able to save those other people. So I'm glad I was in that earthquake. At the time, it was horrific. And for a couple of years afterwards, it was horrific. But I don't regret it. I actually think it's made me a stronger person, for sure.
And you said you had this drive to help people. Was that something like a part of your personality that you had before the earthquake? Because you talk about being, you know, an investment lawyer. So it sounds like a bit of dichotomy there.
Perhaps that's one thing why I didn't quite like my job as well. I felt it was a bit soulless, but it was, you know, you're in your 20s and you're trying to find out, you're trying to make some money, you're trying to fulfill these dreams, and you're not possibly really being true to yourself. But ironically, what happened is the night I arrived in BAM and I went for dinner with my friend turned around to me and says, "What do you truly want to do with your life, Ruth?" I said, "I want to set up a children's charity. I'm really interested in children. I've always wanted to do that." And I think that's because The few years earlier, you know, I'd been on these big travels and I've seen a lot of poverty with children and so forth, and it always really touched my heart. And after I was in this earthquake, I was on the BBC Breakfast News one morning on the show, and I then got contacted by an Iranian family to, and I became a director of a children's charity called Actions for Orphans. And that was looking at children who had been split up from their families in the earthquake and then bringing them all back together again. And some children obviously were permanently orphaned. We couldn't find the parents, had been killed. But the charity brought siblings together, because siblings in the chaos, you know, a whole city's down, they get spread out across the country. You know, it's very difficult for authorities. It would be in any country to control that. So we brought these children to home so they could have a family environment. So ironically, it was a catalyst for something good as well.
Yes, absolutely. And you mentioned after that experience, there was a big effect on you as far as, you know, what you were going to do with your life and how you kind of managed work-life balance.
Sure. So after that, it was like, I decided to keep in a permanent role when I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. It was a normality. And I think when you do have really bad trauma, it's important to have some grounding, even if you don't like your job. It's grounding at the end of the day, and it helps that. But afterwards, there was this desire, you know, I want to write. I've always written. I want to travel more. And so I just made some big changes, and I thought, when I had, you know, I got made redundant, it was like this opportunity. My life was basically saying, go right now, go do this. So it allowed me to concentrate on my writing and so forth. And I went off and lived in Thailand for a couple of years. Just so I was very, you know, I sat down and wrote not a book about the earthquake because I didn't want to write about it. I wrote another book about China because I've traveled a lot in China. I was very disciplined. I used to sit down for about 6-7 hours a day and just write. And I'm this tropical paradise and everyone's thinking I'm mad. I'm like, no, it's you. As a writer, you have to be hugely disciplined. And then when I came back in 2013, I wasn't quite sure what to do. I didn't want to go back to London, but I wanted to keep on my writing career. And I was having difficulty finishing this book. And a friend suggested I do this master's program in Sheffield, where I was originally born. And I thought, great, so I moved back up here as a base, and I joined a master's program, and my tutor at the time discovered this story and said to me, "You've got to write it." And I was like, I'm not writing it. And he badgered me, and I hated him for every minute of him. And I'm so thankful now, because he's brilliant. I think he knew I was very competitive, which I think helped me in the earthquake, because it was that I almost felt competitive that I had to get more people out than my friend in this earthquake. And weirdly, certain attributes, which in certain situations may not be very positive, can be positive in other things. And he knew that sort of mentality that I had is I'm very determined. I don't like to be told no. if someone says I can't do something, I will go and prove them wrong. So he kept saying to me, you're not going to write this book, are you? And I go home, I go and sit home and cry in the bath, get same, and then I wrote it. And then, you know, I got a very good result. I was then applied to literary agents, which is a terrible experience. And I feel so much for people that who are writers trying to get literary agents. But I had so many agents interested in it. And I've got a fantastic agent now, John Wood. And he read it from the start, and he read it within the day and called me up and said, I want to represent you. So being in this earthquake has had some fantastic outcomes as well as the negative side.
In terms of getting it published, you know, you just won the Page Turner Award. What's it like? You know, we hear lots of discussions about how challenging it is to get books published. What's been your experience as a new author with, you know, obviously an incredible ability to tell stories and a, you know, an incredible story?
Well, funny enough, the book now has won 4 awards, as well as just this recent one. And I think, I remember someone saying to me, certain publishers may not get it because you're a woman. They might not know how to place the book because you're a woman. Because if you think about bravery, if you look at television shows, these disaster programs, it's usually some bloke saving someone. Women are allowed to save people, but it's usually in the context of saving their child, or they're some victim and their trauma, and that's so forth. And if women are portrayed as brave, they're usually a caricature. They're like Wonder Woman. They're like Spider Woman, that sort of thing. And so I think sometimes it's quite a hard concept to get around people to understand women can be as brave. They can be very strong as well. You know, I was lifting girders. I was, when adrenaline hits, you know, you become like the strongest man or woman in the world suddenly. And so I think this book does challenge that. It challenges the prejudice sometimes that women face when, you know, we're allowed to be brave in only limited circumstances. So again, I think it opens up people, and especially children, actually. I always say to children, and I often go into schools to speak about my career choices and what happened to me in that disaster. And just saying it in a way, you know, we all have the ability, whether you're a girl or a boy, to do really brave things. And we don't have to be categorized.
You know, I think that's so powerful. One thing I noticed in the outdoor industry is every video and every photo is some young, you know, handsome person that's in perfect fitness. But when you're actually in the outdoors, it is like the most diverse place I ever go. And it's old people, young people, kids, you know, rich, poor, everybody, you know, every religion, every gender, every race. And it's like this huge melting pot. But for some reason, the portrayal is not the 99%. It's this 1%. I always feel it's a really false portrayal of like what type of people like doing these things. And your example of it doesn't fit into like the narrative that I think publishers are used to portraying, that, you know, here's Bear Grylls and he's an ex-SAS and he's strong and fit and, you know, well-spoken. And I feel like your story is really important because of that, because it tells a much more human voice than, like, none of us are ever going to be Bear Grylls. But I'm identifying, you know, as you're talking, I was putting myself in that, you know, in your position. I had goosebumps at some point just thinking, how would I react? And I think that's a really valuable voice to hear and a story to hear, because it is just such a human aspect. I've been really thankful just to hear this. And like Karen said, I can't wait to read your book, because it just, you know, if this is what we get for 30 minutes, I can't wait to get 300 or 400 pages to dive in more.
Thank you.
Ruth has this incredible podcast, Extreme Holidays. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes. It is just a bunch of incredible people telling real stories about extreme holidays. And I think it's, you know, again, a really interesting, this authentic voice, not a whole bunch of celebrities, but authentic voices. Ruth also has a really interesting website, ruthmillingtonauthor.com. We'll put that in the show notes. There's lots of information on there. If you want to, you know, you go back and there's, you know, links to interviews to hear, you know, to read what happened in real time. Really interesting. But I just want to say thank you, Ruth. Like, this has been an incredible podcast. I really enjoyed, you know, seeing how, you know, Karen, yourself and myself, we all kind of had things that changed our life and put us onto kind of a non-traditional path. I know myself, I'm much happier hearing from you. You found the right path. I know Karen has said the same thing. It's nice to connect with other people who kind of took a different route and found a different thing. I haven't been a hero, you have. But you make me realize that in these type of situations, we're all humans and we probably all do the same thing, trying to help other people we don't even know, just this human aspect of preservation. So this has been incredible. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I definitely appreciate it.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you both.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. If you liked it, why not give us a review? Better yet, subscribe and get inspired again and again. Also, if you want to find your own adventures, why not check out 10adventures.com, where you can use our free resources to plan your own trip or book a tour in over 60 countries and make your own epic memories on your next adventure.